Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to and hopefully enjoy. Joining me today, like normal, is Juliana.
Hello everyone.
And today is Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Yay. That's it. That's all I have to say about that. I hope everyone else has had a happy Valentine's Day with their partner. We went out for, we went out to the bread sommelier.
Yeah.
We went to a bakery and ate bacon and cheese.
Had a brunch.
Not bacon.
Baked
bread and cheese plates bread. And eggs. And stuff. It was just a fun brunch.
Yes.
So yeah. Anyway, let's get on to today's book. No, actually, instead of me just like randomly going straight into this book review, I'm going to actually look at my notes that I made two, yeah. 3 days ago when I was planning this podcast. Oh no, the notes just go straight into it. Because we're talking about one of the SFBRP must reads, which is our list of books, or our planned list of planned books of masterworks. It's our own masterworks list.
It's a full list, and there's some contenders to go on.
Yeah, there's still some
it
contenders. One I just noticed here, one of the things that I made a note of is that we're worrying that there's no books from the 1970s on the list.
And that is like, a continued worry.
But
you're
also
right.
On the bottom of the list here, there's a few contenders which I haven't got to check out. You know, well, one of them was Roadside Picnic. Turns out was published in 1971, translated into English, published in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And that's sitting there waiting for, you know, a final decision if it's going on the list or not.
To be honest, I finished that book.
Oh, you did finish that book. You said you were going to make a decision about it. So what do you think? It goes on the must-reads list or not? Or is it a bit, you couldn't get into it, could you really, so much this time?
No. I did read it. I did finish it. It was a bit with time off and on.
Yeah.
And it is very particular,
yes,
very peculiar,
yeah,
but I do think it is very special,
yes,
and I do think it should go on the list,
yeah,
because
okay.
it like, you know, books, any books by Jeff Vandermeer,
yeah,
kind
it's
of
weird
feel,
science fiction before yeah. weird science fiction
yes.
was a thing,
and Roadside, like Jeff Vandermeer's books kind of feel like if Roadside Picnic wouldn't have been there.
You're talking about the Area X, what's it called? Annihilation,
etc. These books feel like a kind of like a direct ancestor.
Okay, cool. Well, right, that's
Picnic.
It. We have already solved it. Roadside Picnic, published in 1971 by Arkady and Boris Strugatsky, is we're going to put it onto the SFBRP must-reads list.
Yes.
It'll be.
I think it's a good book to have read.
Good. Well,
in the
let's
science
do
fiction
it.
Realm.
I think it's very good. But again, I literally said here, it's good, but Luke feels it doesn't add much beyond what Solaris accomplished earlier, and it's only influential to a limited number of following novels. However, Juliana will reread it and make the final decision on whether it makes it onto the must-reads list. And we reviewed that like 25 episodes ago on episode 554.
Okay.
And you're saying it is going on, it will go on.
Yes.
Good. The other thing is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, released 1979, is also on the consideration list. So maybe I'll just listen to that again as an audiobook
I've never read it, actually.
You've never read it?
No.
But you've seen the movie?
I've seen the movie.
Well, that can be a future read.
Yes.
I think it's a better book than it is a movie.
And I did not know that it was a book from the 70s. Absolutely
no,
not.
You thought it was more recent than
I
that.
I thought it felt like a book from the 90s or something.
Okay. Well, that's another thing. So anyway, let's tick those off, or let's say they're going on. Also, there's another one, Fountains of Paradise, but from 1979, is again another book that I want to reread as a consideration of a book from the 1970s that might make
Never heard of that before.
It's Arthur C. Clarke's space elevator book. It's like the first book which made space elevators into like a proper thing, which was then used a lot more in science fiction.
Okay, interesting.
Even the book that you're reading now, Space Elevators.
Yeah.
So cool. Right, let's get on to Anathem by Neal Stephenson.
Okay.
So the funny thing is that I recorded an episode about this in 2009.
Long time ago.
Yeah, yeah. So this book came out in 2009. Yeah. I bought it as a. This was back in the time when I would buy mostly paper books and read paper books.
Yes.
In fact, this is a weird crossover point because I think I always think of this as a deep into the science fiction book review podcast where I did two things. One is I started taking a photo of me holding the book.
Yeah.
Or holding up the audiobook or whatever like that as a photo to use as album art. yeah. And you can actually see it here. Let me bring it up here. So this is that image of me. Aww. In 2009. Yeah, I'm really small then and a little young person. So the first time I ever did that was episode 72.
Okay.
And this is episode 75, just episodes later.
Yeah.
Look, and the next book I read, like 72, The Dispossessed, then 73, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh.
Episode 75, Anathem. Okay.
Wow. How long were those episodes at that point yet?
Well, that's the thing. I look back. I didn't listen back to this episode because I just don't think I can cope listening to myself, whatever I said in 2009.
The early podcasts are However, quite interesting.
This was an episode where I just made loads of notes. So I looked up through all my notes. So I know all the kinds of stuff that I said about it. And here on the blog post about it, the podcast, it says, an epic length review of an epic size novel. Luke tackles Neal Stephenson's Anathem. Guess how much an epic length episode was back in 2009 for me.
45 minutes?
No, an hour and 19 minutes, which is exactly our average length. Every time you're like, hey, let's do this episode in under an hour, it always ends up at 1 hour, 15 minutes. Like it's almost exactly, we get to an hour and you still ask me like three more questions and I go off on two more diversions and then we say thanks to people who
and
are listening.
You can't find an end, so you roll back around five times.
Yeah. So anyway, I read this in 2009. What's that note? Oh yeah, three photos after I started taking photos of myself holding books. And then it was five books before I started listening to audiobooks.
Okay.
So if you actually look at these books here, it's like book, paper,
hardcovers.
Some hardcovers, paper book. And then straight away, Revelation Space, episode 81 was the first audiobook that I listened to and reviewed. And then what's that? The Wind-Up Girl and the City in the City. Still quite a lot of paper books as well, but then getting into more audiobooks as I went through there.
And for your life, it makes sense. It fits.
Yeah. Started having, iPhone. Not iPhone.
iPod.
It was an iPod.
iPod Touch,
yeah. Yeah. And where you could listen to audiobooks more easily than getting them off of CDs or having, 20 tapes, cassette tapes.
Yeah.
Right then. So, yes. And my conclusion in the earlier podcast when I listened to it was masterwork, ? It's bigger than you are. That's what my note was in my notes there. And I quite like that because I always consider... or put it this way, I've often seen people say, you see these things like, this is this person's masterwork. And I was like, no, it's not a masterwork. It's just something that they did. And I always think, and this is my view of what a masterwork is. A masterwork is a work of art that somebody does that ends up bigger than they are, which could be in painting. You just spent a lot of time painting a very big picture and it becomes your masterwork, like a roof of a chapel or a whatever it's going to be, like a big, epic picture. And to be able to do that, you have to be already a master of your craft for it to be worth you spending your time on something which is bigger than you are or that takes years to do. And of course, it's only when you become like a professional author or musician or something that you can spend that much time on something and be so good at it that then you can publish something so chunky, which is a, 1,000-page audio
book. People then want to read.
Yeah, or an audio book, which is, I brought it up here, which is 32 hours and 25 minutes.
Wow.
And people go for it, So that's what I'm saying about masterwork. And not all masterworks then in the canon, but it is something can be your masterwork.
Yes.
I don't have anything like that because I'm too flighty and I never end up spending time on one project long term.
I would disagree here.
Oh, okay. What's my masterwork?
I think, even though it is not a huge big thing, but I think the three born video routine is your masterwork.
Yeah, but it's only 2 minutes long.
It doesn't matter.
I guess the bigness of it is that I have been performing it for over 20 years.
Yes, and that is what makes it big.
Well, I think, in the end, then I think that is a signature piece, but it's not a masterwork, and that can be two different things. Anyway, so either way, my point is that Anathem is a masterwork because it ends up bigger than the author. is.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that's why, you know, these list of books, we have a must reads list. But actually what we're doing is the SFBRP Masterworks list. In other words, these are the books, or these are the texts which end up shaping things or becoming the prime example of something outside of the facts that they're written by any particular author. Mm-hmm. And as it comes down to it, lots of authors who are on the SFBRP must reads list or on the Masterworks list or something, it's not always that, like, oh yes, I love every work by this author. Right. This author isn't my favorite author. Maybe I don't like this author except for this one book. Yeah. Or maybe it's like this author has politics which I would otherwise disagree with, or they were racist in this way, or they've been cancelled in this way. However, they created something that was bigger than themselves. Mm. In other words, it stands aside for themselves. It can stand apart from themselves as the author or creator of that thing.
Right. And yeah. In 2009, you deemed that book, was it?
Yeah, and that's my conclusion back in 2009. Mm-hmm. And that's why, and I gave it 4.9 stars. I didn't give it 5 stars. And again, I couldn't find in my notes why I didn't give it. And I didn't listen back to the episode. But I didn't give it 5 stars.
Yeah.
Because I was saving those for, I don't know, my favorite Ian and Banks books. But I gave it 4.9 stars in 2009. Mm. And now I've reread it again. Because I wanted to go through the SFBRP must reads list again. It's this list of 52 books. It's, what is it? Which are the best examples of science fiction available to read today? Which books are the best for those wanting a deeper dive into science fiction, and which old books stand the test of time, and which new books will we still be thinking about in decades to come? And in my head, this is a new book because it came out since the SFBRP started. Of course, that's now 18 years ago. So
it's not a new book.
It's not a new book anymore. But this is now the first time I've reread it, because of course I haven't reread it. It's 1,000 pages long, and I had, you know, a good time reading it. So here we are, 17 years later after I first read this book. It's my first reread of this book. And here's a question. Does it stand up? And will it be remaining on the SFBRP must reads list?
I think it does. The way you speak about
it. Yeah, of course. It's a really good. And my conclusion is 2009, Luke, that you were saying this book is a masterwork and it stands up on its own and it stands up separately from the author. And also, I have a higher opinion of the book than I do of the author's other work. Holds true.
So basically, you're taking away the question mark that you had in 2009 when you wrote in your notes.
Yeah.
Masterwork question mark?
It's like, yes, this is a science fiction masterwork.
Okay.
And it's quite funny because I was coming off the back of like a bad experience of reading a novel called Snow Crash. Even more influential.
That is actually the only Neal Stephenson book
that you tried to read. Did you finish it?
I can't remember. I did. I actually did finish it.
Either way, loads of people about this. The reason I read this book is that there was loads of opinions of people saying, I loved Snow Crash, but I hated this thing. It's boring. And I was like, well, I hated Snow Crash, so maybe I'll love this. And then I started into it. And other people read reviews like, oh, it's so slow and nothing happens. And there's me reading it, like just gobbling it up. And I would look through the 1-star reviews. This was in 2009. I'm reading from my old notes here. Don't get me wrong. I love Neal Stephenson's The Diamond Age, Cryptonomicon, and Snow Crash. And I was like, I love Snow Crash and appreciated the amount of detail he added to it. I'm a big Stevenson fan. So all of these people go into something as a fan of an author.
Right.
And my point is that if something is good enough, you don't have to be a fan of the author. And in some cases, if they're taking a swing at something else, being a fan of the author might be the wrong way to approach the book.
Yeah.
Which I realize that since I read this book, I've tried maybe one or two other Neal Stephenson books.
Yeah.
And haven't completed any of them. Now, I haven't tried The Diamond Age or The Cryptonomicon, which is other big books, which are held up as his masterwork. So maybe I'll get to those at some point. Who knows? Maybe they're good enough to be on the SFBRP must reads list. Mm. But I like Anathem because it's like a different take on what science fiction can be, but also like a proper fun science fiction book, even though it's over 1,000 pages or 32 hours long. So, yes.
I think actually I read Snow Crash around about the time we met.
Yeah?
I think so. But I can't really remember.
I don't want to get into Snow Crash.
Anathem. The thing is, with Snow Crash, I never tried another Neil Stevenson book.
So that's the thing. This was my second. Neil Stevenson was like burnt by snow crash with Neil Stevenson. And I was like, oh, it was just terrible.
And it's big. And I thought, I want to get myself into that?
I don't think Anathem is a book for you. But there's no reason why it wouldn't be a book for you. Because I think you've read enough science fiction that you would understand why the book is the way it is. Mm-hmm. Now, in our SFBRP must reads list, I give every book like a little thing. And this is Religious Order on Another Planet, because it starts with people who are they're the devout. Just so you know, in this book, everything in Anathem, everything has like a slightly different word. So you don't have insight into something, you have upsight about it.
Okay.
Like, but it doesn't mean insight. It means insight, which means you grok something at a higher level and it like raises your awareness of something, and that's upsight rather than insight.
Okay.
And all the technology, so instead of someone having a mobile phone, they have like a G jar. And instead of this, they have a that. And on the face of it, what so many science fiction and fantasy authors will do, they'll just come up with new proper nouns for everything.
Yes.
But in the end, what they're talking about is, this is television, this is a whatever, this is a thing, this is, you know.
A portable device.
And there's always like a one-to-one relationship between the thing that they're actually talking about and just giving a new name to. Mm. A new science fiction-y proper name to, and the thing that you're reading about.
Yeah.
In this book, what makes it so clever, and what makes the world building so clever in this book, is that it's not set on Earth. Mm-hmm. It's set on, I don't know, Ardo. No, I don't know what the word. Well, I'd have to look it up exactly what it is. But every term that is used, which has a slightly different name, which sounds like a name of something which reflects something in our own, in our world, in our Earth world, in our real world, has a slightly different meaning and a slightly different detail about it.
Okay.
Which you sometimes don't find out what that detail is until like deep into the book. And someone will say something and you're like, oh, this whole time I thought it was referring to something which was exactly like this. But no, it isn't exactly like that. There's one extra step.
So you subtlety know. In there.
There's
as
one
well.
Extra okay. subtlety in it. Yeah. So, so again, that's just one thing that I'm throwing out there. How do I want to approach the review of this book? This book, maybe I just, I don't know, it's a masterwork book. It's a must-read book. So maybe just read it into it. So maybe I can just start talking spoilers about this book.
When did it come out?
It came out in 2009 when I reviewed it. 2009.
Oh, yeah. So when you reviewed your first time, it was really fresh.
Yeah, it was a new book. It just came out that year, whatever.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. A book like this reprograms your brain from scratch to understand a world which is built up from scratch, mm-hmm. new, to be like the real world, to be like our world, but it isn't our world. It's subtly different from our world and better in almost every single way to one meaning of better. Again, look at Neil Stevenson's politics in these books. Whatever the better you think is going to be there. Yeah. But it's like one or two notches better.
Okay.
Than our world.
Right.
Reimagined from the Planck length of matter, or like, you know, quantum measurements in atoms. Mm-hmm. Upwards. So if you go all the way down to quantum, like Planck length measurements, and say that's in our world, it's this, like in our human world, in our Earth world,
yeah,
in our 20th century world with us humans in it. And then how about another world which is slightly different, like a parallel world, you know, like on a quantum parallel world, whatever, but everything is slightly different, but not just sort of like everyone's exactly the same, but slightly different, but also it's slightly different from like this kind of like Planck length, like subatomic level upwards.
Okay.
So there are forces, the weak magnetism, and all these forces work the same, like the weak force and the strong force and the electromagnetic force and gravity force, they're the same, but actually the matter that they act on is all slightly different from ours.
Okay.
Even though they have the same molecules, but the molecules don't work. Anyway, see, and you may be like, you're frowning at me thinking, what is this? But the book doesn't explain this until right near the very end of the book. It explains how different that world is and why it's different from our world.
So you basically don't realize and know that And you assume things because you're reading it through your eye, like
you're reading it as though here we are in like another world. It's not our world. It's like our world. You're like, is it in the far future of our Earth? No, it's not in the far future because the geography doesn't work out. You know, like the continents are in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. All that kind of stuff.
Okay.
But all the way through the book, they're talking about the philosophy, like the history of philosophy in that world. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about, actually, let me look at my notes here. So they're talking about these different people in that world. Now I'm scrolling down quite a bit. Yeah, so there's, instead of Plato, there's Protas and, you know, these other ones. And mm-hmm. And there's Procyon stuff instead of Platonic stuff. You know, I've written this down. So there's the Hylian theoretic worlds of multiple cosmi. So he's, in the book, Neal Stephenson has written a whole other parallel history of philosophy and thought going through, you know, there's the point they're talking about Plato and Leibniz and Kant and all this other kind of stuff. And there's like almost a one-to-one relationship between each one of those.
Yeah.
And all the way back at the base of this is like this like Platonic ideal, you know, of like, what is the Platonic ideal of something? It exists outside of our world.
Yes.
But it's a thing that's there. It's like a spirit of something which infuses things to be the things that they are.
Okay.
So, for example, there's a chair, you know?
Yeah.
And so what makes a chair the most chair thing? There's like an essence of chair, the Platonic ideal of a chair.
Yes.
I'm saying that because I'm just looking at you sitting in a chair. And this is, so there's that ideal of something. And let's just talk about, maybe there's a wall of a cave and we're just seeing the two-dimensional shadow of the thing in our universe. Let's just have a little thought experiment of that way. But there exists outside of our world this philosophical ideal of what the chair is. Mm-hmm. And other chairs that we have now are just, you know, expressions of what, a possible expression of what a chair is.
Yes.
Which is going all ideas going back to Plato or whatever.
Okay.
But what if that's actually real? What if that's not just like Plato talking, you know, as I always talk about, philosophy is just stuff that a person has made up in their brain.
Yeah.
What if that's actually true? And then there's multiple universes and each one of them is one step slightly further away from the actual Platonic ideal.
Yeah.
And, spoilers for the end of the book, people have come from different worlds into another world. Mm-hmm. And you can tunnel from one realm of reality into the next. Mm-hmm. And each one that you go through, you get closer to the Platonic ideal of that world.
Okay.
More spoilers for the end of the book. Some humans from Earth, our world, our 20th century, our real world,
yeah,
are some of the people who've traveled across a boundary, mm-hmm, into a world which is closer to the Platonic ideal of,
right,
that thing.
I see, yes.
And more spoilers, the world that all of the book is happening is like a more closer to the ideal of everything world, mm-hmm, than our world.
Yeah.
So when you're reading through this stuff, you're like, okay, this is good. But sometimes, oh, that's a bit easy. Oh, those people are a bit better. Those people are good. And as you go through, you realize that everything is heightened up one level closer to the Platonic ideal of each thing that's in the book is one step closer to the Platonic ideal of the thing that it could possibly be.
Okay.
So the book is positing, and you only find out about this like deep, like really deep into the book, you're like, oh, everything that I've read in this book so far, everything that's called a G-jaw instead of a mobile phone, it's a mobile phone, but it's one step closer to the Platonic ideal of what a mobile phone should be.
Okay.
The people that are there, the philosophers that they have, are all one step closer to the Platonic ideal. The people who are there are like one step better people. Like the mathematicians are one step better mathematicians doing one step better mathematics.
Okay.
To whatever it is.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so it's like everything in the book book is one step closer to the Platonic ideal from where we are to what we think the Platonic ideal is.
Right.
And this book, this is written from the ground up with this idea as the foundation of a science fiction book, which on the face of it, you read it, it's just a dumb science fiction book where people are going on adventures and doing ice trudging and all this other kind of stuff that happens in science fiction books where you need to get around a planet and everything's slightly different. You know, on the face of it, they're just, and at one point there's a space adventure and there's a planet adventure and there's, you know, people shooting at each other and getting into fights and it's like some kung fu stuff because Neal Stephenson can't help himself.
Okay.
But at every moment of that, what the people who are in there, like you've got these, you know, kung fu monks and they're kung fu monks who are just slightly better than the best kung fu monks we actually have here on Earth. So everything feels heightened up to this level of fantasy. But it's not fantasy. It's philosophical science fiction down to the quantum level.
Right. I totally understand why that is something that interests you. I have a question here now that comes to my mind straight away. If you say that humans manage to go to that place through some whatever wormhole or whatever, then it must also have been that the people from that other world also travel one further on to get one, you know.
There's a chain, again, spoilers for the end of the book. There's a chain of people, like one civilization, like I think four more realities down the chain, broke through into the next one, and they then got other people together on their big spaceship, made the spaceship even bigger, and then they broke through to the next one, and then those people came through. There's no going back, there's only going forwards.
Yes. Okay, so there is, because that would have been like crazy if that wouldn't have been the case.
It's not like everyone's just arriving here. No, but there's a chain of, but again, all of that's revealed much, much deeper into the book than you would think it should be revealed when it's the foundation of the thing. It's the foundation of the universe that you're reading.
Yes.
The world building that you're reading is only like the true nature of the level of world building is only revealed to you like 2/3 of the way through the book. This might be the thing that's going on.
So this is the kind of book that kind of rewards you for continue reading and like going towards the end to actually get that reveal. So let me put it this way. If you are a fan of other Neal Stephenson books and you start reading this book.
Yeah.
And it you're
expecting
you
Snow
nothing.
Crash. This is not a book for the people who read Snow Crash and are satisfied by it.
Yeah. Okay.
That's why when I read the book, and again, I don't remember why I gave it 4.9 stars instead of 5 stars. And again, I didn't listen back to the episode about it. But my notes about it are me just marveling that somebody can write a book. And this is like what one of the notes I meant. I said, Stevenson has, in some ways, started from such a low level. And as he says in the book, the lower the level, the more important it is. I said, I realized about 3 novel lengths into the book, because it's about the size of 4 novels, that bits and pieces of technology that I thought were just flavor relied on the fact that Stevenson knows the quantum levels in the atom. I think what I'm saying is like the Planck length of the measurements in an atom. And it's not just that, but the slight differences in these quantum levels or Planck lengths between different possible universes would make for interesting interactions. And then these interactions make up interesting plot points later on in the novel. So it's, and this is what I appreciate about this, is that I think I've maybe read this book and maybe 3 other science fiction novels ever, which start from base level assumptions about the Planck length of, of, you know, matter in the science fiction universe.
Yes.
Work out an entire, slightly different philosophical history. Take a history which goes back 4,000 years, and that the 4,000 years in that of philosophical history in the novel is just as real to the people in the novel as our, you know, 2,000, 3,000 years of, you know, traceable culture and storytelling and philosophical thought.
Yes.
And all of that's like worked out in advance of the novel beginning. And then you read about a 200-page novel of just like young monks in this big monastery. It's called a math, you know, sort of like these kind of secular, non-religious monks learning about science and technology and writing books and doing things and working on projects.
Yeah.
It's like 200 pages of them describing how they wind up the clock and how when the bells ring and, you know, all of these different kind of stuff. And then talking about events that happen only once every 10 years and then other events which happen only once every 100 years. You know, it's like a 200-page, you know, mystery kind of thing about what's going on. Some people are being asked to leave and we don't know. There must be something important going on because they keep asking people to leave, and that once they leave they can never come back up in, and you know, all this crazy stuff. You don't know what's going on, and there's lights in the sky and people are like tracking things and turning cameras on and off, but they're not real cameras, they're like, you know, strange science fictiony cameras which work slightly different. And it's like reading a 200-page novel and you just don't even understand what's going on at all.
Yeah.
But right from the start, and then this is my first time rereading it, it starts off and it's sort of like, right, we're going to have a Socratic dialogue, although they don't call it that. It's sort of like, now we're going to have like three people in this. I'm the person asking the questions and you're going to be the person replying to the questions. But then there's also a third person in the Socratic dialogue. It's the person who's watching it who actually learning the real thing, because they're just thinking about. And so you have these like dialogues and trialogues and all this kind of stuff. And like the first one of them is like, oh, you've just given away the whole book.
But you only realized that
on the second read, I'm like, oh, it's like chapter one. They start talking about things
from the beginning.
What you're asking about, like this hypothetical thing that this master scientist person is asking about right at the start of the book, is sort of like, oh yeah, last time I read the book, that was revealed like three quarters of the way through the book that's actually the case. And I was like, it's right here at the start. So it's just one of those. It's just. And that's why it's a book. Again, I could go into lots of other details about the book.
Yeah.
But the reason why it's a masterwork is because it's a fun... Let me actually just go through it. So, like I say, the first 250 pages is it's a mystery set in a convent. It's a bit like Name of the Rose. Have you read The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco?
I've seen the movie.
You've seen the movie. Okay. Was it Sean Connery?
Yes, Sean Connery.
Christian Slater. Yeah, yes. I've seen the movie as well. Yep. But that is sort of like...
Very good.
It's just... Yes, it's a very good book as well. It's like... I don't know. It's probably probably won all the prizes as well.
Yeah,
Name of the Rose.
Yeah.
Amazing book. I'd kind of want to reread that, but it's not like a science fiction book review podcast.
You can just all read other books.
It's one of my all-time favorite books.
Just go read it.
Yeah, I should get back to it. But that's just full of descriptions of this and descriptions of doors and descriptions. And you kind of like build up a mental math of the whole monastery, and you're going around here and this person's there and that person's there and that person's got ink on their fingers and that person doesn't have ink on their fingers. You know, all this different... And that's what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next 300 pages is that they some of them get sent out from there,
mm-hmm.
out from like some of these, you know, avouts, these like friars or monks or whatever they're meant to be, get sent out. And then it's like this quest novel, like planetary romance, and it's like a guy who is like a foreigner in his own land because he's like out of there, and then he goes here and he knows it, and his sister comes along with him, and his sister has a thing, and he meets up with people, and then they go from place to place, and there's this big adventure that they're going along. This is like a 300-page novel, and there's ice slogging in this. You know what I said before in the... you get the Left Hand of Darkness, and there's the whole section where people slog across the ice.
Yes.
And then there is other books. Did I make a note about this here as well? Oh, I thought I did. I made a note about ice slogging and other books which I've read recently that did this too. Neverness. That's another book that I put on here by David Zindel. They have ice slogging. They have like two parts where people have to go across the ice. And Ancillary Justice does this as well.
Yes.
There's another section there where they're like, "All right, now we're on this cold planet and we've got to get there." And it's a very fun science fictional thing to do, is to get two people together or a few people together in the ice, because then they're desperate and they're uncomfortable, and when they're in close quarters, because you've got to be, because otherwise you get too cold.
Warmth, yeah.
Yeah, you get to do ice trudging, ice slogging, and characters emerge.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. You get to know the people really well.
Yeah. So that's that big thing, and then there's, you know, like all that kind of stuff. So then they get to where they want to go, and then it becomes like a political maneuvering thriller kind of thing where suddenly factions pop up and this people want that and then people want this. And then there's like, this is where like the theorics is resolved, which is the, you know, the philosophy of maths and all that science stuff. That's kind of like revealed then. And then the last 200 pages is like this pure spaceships, laser action in space, zero gravity, space battles, and, you know, the running around a spaceship and all that kind of stuff. And it feels very Heinleinian, like juvenile novel. It feels like Space Cadet or Have Spaceship Will Travel, where someone who's quite young, like the guy in the book's like 19, 20 years old or whatever he is.
Yeah.
And he's like in love with this girl, and then he's having this fun adventure where things are going right, and you know, people chasing around spaceships, like I say, and it's like, oh, now we're just doing fun classic science fiction. So it feels like as you're going through this book, you're going through like different stages of like fiction and science fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, you get the kind of like capsule thing, you get the planetary adventure thing, you get like the, you know, quirky political maneuvering kind of stuff, and then you get the space, it's all paid off with the space battle. And it's got this forward thrusting like narrative. At any point you'd be like, well, this is happening a long time, but at any point anything could be happening. There could be like, you know, ninja monks coming out and having a fight here, you could be falling in a crevasse there, you could be like discovering secret passages here. You can be double crossed here. You could be standing in front of a big crowd and having to make a speech. You could be learning a song here. Like at every moment, just random shit could, well, not random shit could happen, but like stuff's happening all the time.
Yeah.
For like 1,000 pages or like 32 hours of audiobook, it's kind of relentless how much more stuff is happening all the time.
Okay. But it feels like the opposite of slow.
No, that's the thing. When people go, oh, nothing's happening, and they've just described a clock too many times, I'm like, yeah, but every time they describe a clock, like, we learn something new about how the world works. That's what I was thinking the first time I read it. And now I'm like, well, yeah, of course they have to describe the clocks. If they don't describe the clock now, we're not going to understand what's going on later on with the .. you know, whatever it's going to be. So
when you're reading this book, take everything seriously. Don't discard something because you think, oh, it's just a description of something.
Yeah. No, there is no wasted description. And again, it's a long book, but if you're rebuilding what the world is like from like the Planck length up, and if you're reanalyzing what all of like Western philosophy from Plato up to 20th century, I don't know, phenomenologists or whatever. I don't even know. Like, I'm not interested enough in philosophy to actually know all the correct terminology about that.
And Wittgenstein.
Yeah. All of that kind of stuff where it's just people making stuff up and, you know, convincing each other that that's actually how the world works. When it's not. That's all just happening in their heads. We know that philosophy is just the stuff that's happening inside human heads. Yes, that's it. So it's all fun. It's all fun. Ice trudging. Good stuff. And then it's got stuff which is written in like 2009 where to now it feels like a bit prescient about, like, it's doing stuff there where sort of like this is how the world is working. It's like satire at the time of like what it's like to work in the world. And now it's, some of that stuff is a little bit depressing where I was like, oh, was that progress? And now like in like 18 years later, 17 years later where we are now, you're like, oh, okay, good job.
Okay.
I will, yeah, sorry.
So, basically, this book, especially when you read it, when you read it for the first time, it offered you something, and at the end, there's a clever reveal, and it feels like there's a certain recipe of a book that you really appreciate in that way.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a recipe of a book, but there is, like I say, very few authors do this thing at this level.
Yeah.
Another author that does it is Greg Egan. I mentioned this book today or yesterday, whenever I mentioned it, with Diaspora.
Today, yeah.
It's somebody who goes, and the start of that book, or a big chunk of the start of that book, is like, right, so how would, if an artificial intelligence is going to be born, how would that happen? And like a huge part of the start of that book is like, right, let's go back to first principles. What is a bit. Okay, a bit right. is like one unit of information. And he builds up from there
yeah.
into an artificial intelligence being born and put out into the world. Mm. And then he's like, right, now this is going to be the main character of our story. And you're like, holy shit, like mathematically you've gone back to like root causes
yeah.
and built up from the ground up mm-hmm. a character that we know down to the neuron in the brain.
Yeah.
You know, that's fresh in my mind because what's the ancillary book review? What's it called? The Meal of Thorns yeah. podcast just did an episode about that, or just released an episode about
that. The Greg Egan's
Diaspora. Yeah. So that's one that's fresh in my mind.
Yeah.
That's another SFBRP must reads list that I gave 5 stars to. Because
okay.
it's someone who can go back and, like, in this case, he does it up. Greg Egan does it up front. Mm-hmm. And he also says about his writing, like, hey, be ready. You might need a notepad and a pen mm-hmm. to keep track of the concepts and what's going on here. Mm-hmm. And I might describe something mathematically, which will be a bit confusing unless you write it down as a diagram. But when you do, you're going to really appreciate the next thing. Or, you know, you get. I mean, he doesn't say that inside, like within the pages of the book.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of level that some authors are willing to write at.
Yeah.
And what Anathem does, or what Neal Stephenson does with Anathem, is he disguises that work that
yeah.
he's done and the work that he's expecting you to do as a reader. But once you cotton on to what he's expecting you to do as a reader
yeah.
and you appreciate it, mm-hmm. it's sort of like, wow, that's a reading journey that I haven't had before. And now on my first time rereading this book, I've reread Greg Egan's Diaspora like two or three. I've definitely read the book itself three times.
Yeah.
So I've reread it twice.
Okay.
And that's kind of like very upfront about what it's doing.
Is that on our must read list?
Yes, of course it's yeah. on the must read list. It's a it's one of the few 5-star books.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is, 1997. It's called Deep Future, because that's also a book which goes, all right, now, 80,000 years later, and you're like, wait, what?
What?
It's sort of like, oh, no, don't worry, time works different here. And you're like, what? And it's sort of like, no, I explained. We explained how it works. So, yeah, and that's kind of building up from the ground up. And again, a few authors do that explicitly, like with Pandora's Star.
Yes, that was, I was just trailing off in my head.
Yeah, like trying to think of other books.
And I thought, like, that is very much like a Pandora Star level of...
Yeah, where he goes, all right, how does evolution work? Mm-hmm. How does biology work? Mm-hmm. How can, from scratch, I create we just want to do alien invasion stuff,
mm-hmm.
but to have a convincing alien invasion, we need a reason why aliens want to invade. Let's go back to, like... the dawn of life. Let's go back to like a single bacteria next to a pond on a mountain.
Yes.
On a different planet years away,
yeah.
which is inside a Dyson sphere or whatever it's going to be.
Like, yeah.
So yeah, that stuff you've got to, that is the kind of level of world building.
Mm.
But on top of that, the book itself still has to be good.
Yes.
But I like the challenge of an author who's willing to go back to not just first principles, but even go, what are even principles?
Yeah.
<You know? laughs>
yeah. Like, question everything.
Like, not even question everything, but like consider everything back to that
yes.
level. And of course, it's not perfect. Like, none of these things can actually be perfect
because they are written
in our world, and only us humans in our world can understand them. And that's what Greg Egan's doing, is sort of like, yeah, so when we get to the 9th dimensional version of this, like, we can't understand mm-hmm. it, but someone in the book will create a 5-dimension version of themselves that can talk to a 7-dimension version of themselves, which can talk to the 9-dimension version of themselves, which can talk to the 11-dimension version of themselves.
And then they talk it back.
Yeah, and then they all explain it back to each other.
Yes.
It's like, right, you can't understand here, but he explained it to me, and I'm like a step, you know,
yes.
when you actually get to an author who's willing to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You can really break it down. And again, the other books as well. Like, I do think, like, 1984 does that with like language. It's
yep.
almost like a textbook of political manipulation of mm-hmm. language and mm-hmm. how changing language does different things. And as you're going through the book, but that, I think that's more like talking about it, and it doesn't act on your brain in a way. This
yep.
book acts on my brain. You read a book like this, and it slowly rewires your brain.
Yeah.
So when you get to the end of the book, and you're like, oh, the ending was a bit unsatisfying, And then you think it through, like, and then go, but was it unsatisfying? Because then you're like, oh no, right, I see. This is I don't know. It's one of those, it's a tricky nail it all and put it all together is a bit difficult. And I got to the end of the book this time, and I was like, oh yeah, this is how it ends. And you're like, okay. And then you have to consider how it's ending. Like, is it just an easy ending? Is it a happy ending? What's the deus ex machina that may or may not happen?
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to read it.
You have to continue the work.
Yeah, yeah. It leaves it up to you to decide. Yeah. In which universe's rules is this storytelling working in?
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Yeah, it makes sense.
So you've got to get to.
That's good. And I guess because of all those reasons that you just said about the book not being all perfect and stuff, I think this is where you gave it 4.9.
Yeah, maybe as well.
Yeah.
So a few little things. We had a conversation about this last year when I was listening to this audiobook. Because I listened to this in like November, October, whenever it was.
Yeah.
So there's this really interesting thing that's revealed, is that there's the internet in this book, but it's not the internet. It's like this other kind of network. But all the time, there's so much shit being flung around the network that it's actually really difficult to pipe through real stuff, because it's just full of malware and bots that are coming up with stuff and just spewing it onto the net, like onto the net all the time. So it's actually really difficult to use the internet properly.
Kind of sounds familiar.
So so there's this section where he's explaining, like, or two characters are talking to each other, and that they said, in the early days of the net, there was good crap, which was what people did, and bad crap. And he was saying that it's actually hard to generate bad crap on the internet.
Yeah.
Because all you have to do is copy stuff. And bad crap is, in the book, it said that it's something which is really convincing as that it could be true.
Yeah.
And so bad crap is the stuff that could be true, but is just slightly untrue enough. And it's like this. And so in the book, in 2009, or 2008, when this was written, he was describing that there's this level of crapness, which is the most dangerous level of crapness, which is very, very close to real, but everything is just, 10% of everything or 1% of everything is just slightly off, that it can't be trusted. And that's like the base layer of the entire internet is just this level. And he says it was hard to generate, and then what really put it down is that they made artificial inanity systems. And I was like,
that all sounds so familiar.
So the change of the word isn't like artificial intelligence systems, it's artificial inanity systems. Mm-hmm. Systems which were designed so well that they could just keep spewing out really high level crap, which is almost everything exactly true, but everything is just slightly not true enough. Yeah. It's just at that one level down.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you're reading it, sort of like, oh, so this is like the platonic ideal of, like, now what we call them is large language models, which are just set to auto-spew, which just hallucinate just enough that you can ask them questions. And, like, the Google Gemini answer machine at the top of Google search is just crap enough that it'll give you answers which feel convincing that they're actually real answers, but everything is just slightly off, or could be slightly off.
Yeah.
Not that everything is a lie, because if everything is a lie, you just don't read it.
Yes.
But everything could be true. So, anyway, it's a really fun description of how the internet, or how the web or the net or whatever they keep connecting to,
like the
threads or the weave, or I can't remember what it's called in this book,
like the guy who googled about how he can reduce his salt intake, and then that Google Gemini or machine or something, or ChatGPT or something, told him, oh yeah, you can replace it with a natrium bromide or something. And then he bought it online and ate a natrium whatever it is,
like, and like not sodium chloride,
but he was just like he was just poisoning himself.
Because
and it sounds like if you just don't do any more research, okay.
It's sort of like, what was the question? Yeah. Like, I can't get the salami to stick to the top of my pasta. No, sorry, the pizza. So yeah, that was it. It was a pizza.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I can't get the ingredients to stick to the top. And they're like, well, what you should use is super glue. And they're like, what? And you trace it down, and there's like this famous, or at least a Reddit post where someone who's trolling was sort of like, you should use super glue to get internet.
So this is the kind of the internet stage we are at,
anyway,
at right
it
now.
It was just really funny to read something from 2008 with someone who understands, again, Neil Stephenson, like, literally invented the term metaverse, which is now one of the biggest companies in the world and one of the main AI companies in the world, renamed themselves Meta to be in reference to the metaverse because they wanted to make, you know, not artificial intelligence. At the time, it was all like, oh, we're VR labs, you know. Yes. Mark Zuckerberg is all like, oh, we want to do headsets. Yeah. And now all of now they're all like, no, not that. Now we're going to do AI. Mm. And I was like, please read Anathem and understand what, just please rename your company Artificial Inanity Systems or Artificial Inanity. Don't keep talking about AI boom and AI this and AI that. But we're in such a crazy world now because we live in a world where the Turing test, and I think I mentioned this in a previous podcast, it's so trivially, the Turing test now is so trivially beaten by computers.
Yeah.
Which even when I started, when I started SFBRP, that wasn't the case. Large language models didn't work that way. You had Markov chains, which could do something, but very quickly they'd always get into a loop and always get into now. And now I can have conversations with something that I know it's AI, so I'm not being fooled that it's not AI, but most people in the world can't tell the difference between something that's written by AI and something that's written by a human now.
Yes.
And that's by design. You know, that's how the system should work.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's good or not. I'm just saying it's funny to read science fiction
from 2008.
From a pre-large language model-based thing. And Neil Stephenson already got it, that these machines will be used as artificial inanity systems to... And the internet
AI
is going
swap.
To be... The actual human-level activity on the internet is going to be this thin layer over AI systems which are actually using at any point 99% of the capacity of the internet. And that is currently what's happening now.
Yes.
Currently, internet websites are being, the bots, the AI bots, are accessing these websites.
They're scraping it.
They're scraping it, but they just keep coming back and hitting it over and over again to the point where lots of people, you have to have Cloudflare services which, block them or can actually put up with the traffic, because people's traffic is going up by 100 times, but not human visitors. It's all bot traffic to high-value, you know, text sources or whatever it's going to be.
Yes.
And again, Neil Stephenson was he was on that 17 years earlier than it actually happened.
That is quite...
And it's a throwaway conversation about the history of the internet in a science fiction world.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh man, you're really clever. Why can't all your books be like this?
Yeah.
And that's what I appreciate about this.
Yeah. Cool.
Again, this is of the books that I think I reviewed for the SFBRP.
Mm-hmm.
Snow Crash, I gave 0.5 stars. Seven Eves, I didn't finish. I can't remember what I gave it, but that's another massive book. I got 2/3 of the way through and I'm like, nah, I'm out. I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And then this book, I'm 5-star masterpiece.
Yeah, that's
masterwork,
crazy,
and
right? It's
you,
the
but
same,
you don't know. You don't know what you're going to get.
It's the same author. And it really depends on what they concentrate and put their teeth in at the time.
Yeah. All right, let's bring up here. So this was Hugo Award nominated in 2009, Locus Award won in 2009.
Okay.
Also nominated for the Arthur C. Clarke Award, the British Science Fiction Association Award nominee for Best Novel, the Endeavour Award nominee. Don't know what that is. It's...
What's the rating on Goodreads?
On Goodreads, average rating is 4.17. Which is pretty good.
Okay.
Let's look at some of our friends' reviews.
Mm.
So Kemper rated it 5 stars, one of the most challenging books I've read and the one that got a lot of satisfaction out of finishing. So that's good. Jenny from Reading Envy, she wrote 5 stars. I have a hard time explaining this book without giving things away that are revealed through the story, but I found it much easier to read than Stevenson's Baroque Cycle, even though it was still full of math and philosophy and made up words.
Yeah, that's his thing.
So Search rated it 5 stars, B 5 stars, Terence Blake 5 stars, Jeremy 5 stars, Joshua 5 stars, Ahmed 5 stars, Tyler, David, and there's more reviews. Click on this. Ed, Felix, Niels, Tamer, Jeff. Oh, he said wants to read. He doesn't give it 5 stars. Rajesh, Mario, the lone bookwolf is the first person to give it 4 stars.
Ooh. A deviation.
And then Gregory 4 stars, Ryan 4 stars. Let's see if I can get down to anyone who's given it less than 4 stars. Oh, here we go. Paul Spence rated it 3 stars. Sandy, 2 stars. Matthew Kern rated it 2 stars. What a slog. I think this book would have been challenging to understand reading it slowly, but was doubly challenging as an audiobook. Yeah. To be honest, I think I would have struggled if I went straight into this as an audiobook the first time out.
Yeah.
I think I would have been more challenged than I was.
And it makes sense. Like, especially in a world where there's lots of invented words, and if you can't see them, sometimes they don't click with your brain and there's a different kind of connection with your eyes.
Yeah.
Eye word reading.
Yeah.
Than ear word reading.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And quite a few people giving it 3 stars. Paul, boring, did not finish, 1 star.
All right.
And Terp Kristen, usually I love Neal Stephenson novels,
and
2 stars.
And these reviews, when are they from?
Oh, yeah, a lot of them are from 2009, yeah. 2010, 2011, 2014.
One of those books that...
Oh, no, here's someone who rated it. Yeah, Matthew Kern rated it in 2024.
Okay.
So it is still being read.
Okay, cool. I'm just saying, like, of the people who didn't read it at the time or finished it or didn't like it or whatever, this might be the kind of book that 17 years later, when you are also 17...
Yeah, maybe.
It might have a different impact on...
I bounce off lots of books and never give them another chance. And, like, I don't blame anyone for not retrying a book like that they didn't finish 17 years later just because they're 17 years older.
Yes.
So, yeah, lots of good reviews, lots of high ratings, and then lots of people... down in the main thing giving it I can't find the graph. Where's the graph? There's always a graph. This graph.
Oh, yeah.
You see that one there?
Yeah.
Where it's like the shape of the graph,
the column
shows why it's, because something can have loads of 5-star reviews and loads of 1-star reviews and then like a
bell curve.
An inverse bell curve.
Right.
Like this is just a straight, you know, like solid, like 46% 5 stars, which is a high
Huge.
Number there.
Yeah.
And then 30% 4 stars, 13% 3 stars, 4% 2 stars, and 2% 1 star. So in other words, it's a good looking drop off for lots of people think it's very good, then fewer people think it's, but other times very few 5 stars, quite a lot of 4 stars, loads of 3 stars, and then less 2 stars and less 1 star. So you're like, oh, that's the bell curve in the other way. You get these outward bell curves, inverse bell curves, and then everyone thinks it's good or everyone thinks it's bad. But of course the books that everyone thinks bad there's not a lot of people read them because they don't gain any traction.
Yes.
And
you don't even hear about them.
Yeah. You only hear about the books which are, again, that, and that's why the scale is between 3.5 stars and 4.5 stars is the scale that we're going on here.
Yeah.
So, anyway, you said you wanted to finish up this podcast review in 1 hour. It has now been 56 minutes.
Oh, that's nice.
So I did it not talking about the story or the characters or the things that disappointed me about the book.
You dipped into bits and pieces.
I just got straight to the point why people should read this book.
Yeah, I mean, that's all we want, because we still want something to read about.
Yeah. yes, but again, maybe I gave away. Maybe I'm taking away the journey so other people can't. Like, they go into it knowing what to expect, but I had that on my second read-through and I still really enjoyed it.
Yeah, but also, you literally said at the beginning, or relatively at the beginning of this book, that you can't really talk about it without spoiling it.
Well, so the reason why it's such a masterwork...
Yes.
...is the reason why, like, if you read this book like I did the first time, it's a slow realization that it's a masterwork.
Yeah.
In the words of 2009, Luke.
Yeah.
If I'm talking about why it's on the SFBRP must reads list, I'm just going to be upfront about that
and
give the reason.
There's two kinds of people.
Yeah.
One kind of person like me who haven't read this book.
Yeah.
And I will now, I probably want to read it now. Yeah.
Okay.
And just
you know, this is a long book.
I understand.
Will take you 6 months to finish.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, good.
I have read big books before.
Yeah.
And I'd probably not get it from the library.
No, you don't try and finish this in 3 weeks.
One kind of person like me who have not read it.
Yeah.
And have now listened to this podcast. And we will now approach it with a different mindset.
Yeah.
And then there's a person who hasn't read it and stopped before you came to anything about this book and then went on reading it.
And maybe come back to it.
To the podcast.
Like to think that if someone's listened to this podcast, they can still enjoy the book fully as a first-time reader. All right, then. That's it. You can follow me on Goodreads, become my friends, and I can too can see what you are reading.
Yes.
You can suggest things on the SFBRP listener group on yes. Goodreads. That's yes. a good way to do it.
There are a few different threads.
You know, on the last episode, I mentioned a podcast, which was Alistair and...
Emma Newman. Alistair Reynolds on...
It was the guys who are reading audiobooks. And I said it was called Read That. It's like, no, it's called Read That. The podcast is called Read That because they're both red-headed. And I know that's the case. And I know that's the joke, that the double meaning of their podcast is that they read that.
Yes.
But when I just read the name of the podcast, I was like, you know, Alistair and... I can't remember the name of the people.
Yeah.
And I just said, Read That. And then as I listened back to the podcast, I was like, what are you talking about? It's obviously Read That. So anyway, thank you for the other podcast suggestions for other podcasts that I should listen to.
Good. Suggestions are always fun.
That's it. Meanwhile, there was one other thing that I was going to mention.
I don't know. I'm reading Shroud at the moment.
Yes, you're reading Shroud. I've finished Shroud. So that might be the next episode.
Yes.
Whenever we get to it.
Yes.
I've got one other book from the SFBRP Must Reads list that I want to get to and talk to you about.
All right.
But... Well, we need to finish this podcast within the next 4 seconds, so I can't talk about it now.
Okay, let's do it then.
Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.